time as an external presentation for design part of microwave study. He's going to introduce the RDRB and gene findings in this hour. And this section we expect to end at 12:10. And the afternoon section is still begin as scheduled at 1 o'clock. And now let's welcome Dr. Sam.
Okay, I thought we would get right into the gene finding, and the section called BRB Array Tools was really, I think, mostly focused on importing your data. And I don't want to really try to go through the details of, you know, try to actually do any kind of hands-on of importing the data. There's a data import wizard, and I sort of don't want to get too into those details. I'd rather sort of let's focus on the analysis issues, and if we want to, we can come back at the end and run through the, weren't too many slides on that section of BRB Array Tools. So I think let's jump right into class comparison, gene finding, and go through sort of the theoretical aspects of it, and then actually try it out in BRB Array Tools. So I think I'm going to start with going through the some of the theoretical background on it, but it's pretty tuned to what's in BRB Array Tools. We've already seen this, three different kinds of objectives. We know class comparison and class prediction are not clustering problems, because clustering is sort of based on usually these global similarity measures. And to do good class prediction, at least, we're probably going to have to select genes rather than, I mean, in some cases, we can just cluster with regard to all the genes, and we may see our classes separate. But usually, we're going to, if we're after a predictor, we're not going to get it actually just from clustering. So we need supervised methods and replicate samples. We've talked about technical replicates and biological replicates. And we're mostly going to be talking about either single label arrays or dual label arrays using a common reference design. And now, so analysis strategies for class comparison. One basic analysis strategy for say, class comparison is to sort of do it one gene at a time. For each gene, do a comparison, some kind of a comparison of the expression levels of that gene in one class versus the expression levels of that gene in the other class, and using sort of traditional statistical, you know, measures, either parametric like t-tests or non-parametric tests, but to somehow then control for the fact that we're doing it for all the genes, and so we have lots of comparisons. We may have 35,000 comparisons, and we'll talk about what's appropriate for sort of control, the various ways in which we can control for those multiple comparisons and not wind up with too many false positive claims about the number of genes that we claim are differentially expressed. And so what we're really doing is we're saying, one gene at a time, is the average expression in this class different than the average expression in that class? And we have samples from representing different classes, and we want to take into consideration not just the average, but also the variation about that average in the expression within each class. And just like a traditional sort of statistical comparison problem, the only difference being that we have a lot of comparisons. And so the simplest sort of measure is to, for each gene, we do some kind of a t-test. If there are two classes, if there are three classes, the analog of the t-test is the f-test. And we'll get into some other kinds of tests too. So one strategy is to do things gene by gene, and another strategy is to somehow do something we call these multivariate permutation tests. And this, we have two of them in BRBOA tools. One is one that Ed Korn and my group and some of us developed. And another one is SAM, Statistical Analysis of Microarrays, that was developed at Stanford University, which is a very similar kind of test. And we'll talk about how those are different and what they're sort of based on. And this just shows the a screenshot of BRB Array Tools, the dialogue you get when you start to do a class comparison. We can actually do that rather than as a screenshot. We can go to Excel here. And so what I have open here really is just Microsoft Excel, in which I've previously installed BRB Array Tools. And we have, you know, when you download BRB Array Tools from our download site, it comes with an installer, and you just click on it, and it basically installs as an add-in, as a plug-in to Excel. And when it's installed, you see, and our downloader also installs R and the Java the Java evaluation machine. And so what you see is you can tell that BRB Array Tools is installed in Excel because there's this menu that says Array Tools. And but right now, if I want to analyze something, in other words, if I've already imported my data, so at this point I can either try to import my data to BRB Array Tools, but we don't want to go through that, so why don't we just open a sample data set? And I think if we go to getting, if we just highlight getting started, one of the things in that menu is open a sample data set. And sort of built into BRB Array Tools, I think we have just at this point just two sample data sets built in. We're going to add some others. Like, it's easy to sort of download one of those 120 or whatever it is data sets from our download site and just unzip it and open those. But actually, without doing that, there's also two of them built into BRB Array Tools. And this one is one of the, data published by Chuck Peru on patients with breast cancer who got pre versus post chemotherapy expression profiles of their tumors. And so I'm going to just open that data set. It's and this is a very simple data set. BRB Array Tools, when you import your data, it sort of needs three kinds of data. It needs your expression data, and that's one thing. It needs some kind of a gene identifier associated with your expression data, so that it can give you so that it can give you lots of annotations of the genes that it finds significant in your various analyses. So when you actually go through importing your data, part of the importing will be, what kind of gene identifier do you have? Do you have gene symbols? Do you have, for example, suppose you have Affymetrix cell files. Well, we have an automatic importer for those, and we know that we have those probe set IDs that are embedded in the cell files. And so BRB Array Tools uses those to get from the Affymetrix website, NetAffix, a whole bunch of other gene annotations for those genes. And if you're importing other kinds of data, it will want to know, well, what you'll have to tell it, we're not going to go through those import wizard, but there'll be a way of telling it. Do you have gene symbol? Do you have clone ID? Do you have any of the other, a unigene cluster ID? And it doesn't need a bunch of them, but it needs something so that it can then go out and get all of the other annotations. So that's the second thing it needs. And the third thing it needs is what we call the experiment descriptor, an experiment descriptor worksheet. Now, when you're importing your data doesn't have to be in Excel format or anything. It can be on flat files, it can be in cell files. It basically, there's a lot of flexibility to that, and I'm not going through that part of it right now. But once you sort of establish this project, one thing it wants to know is, and it sets up this, what we call experiment descriptor worksheet. And an experiment descriptor worksheet, it has one header row, and then it has one row corresponding to each of your arrays. And the first column is just some kind of an array identifier that you've given it. And the other columns are sort of whatever you want them to be, and using whatever coding you want them to be. And you can add columns to this and change it and modify it during your analyses. It's these columns that you will use to communicate to the program what kind of analyses, what comparisons you want to make. For example, for the Peru data set, it only has two columns of information. One column was a patient identifier. Patient ID 10 means we have two arrays for patient 10. These two rows correspond to patient 10. One was an after chemotherapy, and the other was a before chemotherapy. And similarly for patient 100. And the order of things doesn't make any difference. There is sort of a thing, if you import your data with separate files, then this first column, the identifier here should correspond to your file name of the expression information for that array. But I want to focus really on these sort of things. And so you could have columns with richer data sets, there can be a whole bunch of columns. In other words, we may want to do lots of analyses. And I'll open another data set in a little bit, developed by from a paper by Pomeroy at the Whitehead Institute, that just has a whole lot of columns, some of them I've created to help me drive the kind of analyses I wanted to do on that data. So we've opened this data set, and suppose what we want to do is we want to find the genes, we're in this section on gene finding, that are the change in expression from pre-treatment to post-treatment, okay? And so we go to the menu, and we say, we can do one of two things. I can go right to class comparison, or the other thing that really I think helps you along is something we added in the previous release of BRB Array Tools. We added something called an analysis wizard. And I'll just show you that briefly. Analysis wizard. It says, okay, what do you want to do? Do you want to do gene finding? Do you want to do prediction? Or do you want to do clustering genes or samples? Or do you want to do none of those things? So let's say, well, we want to do gene finding. Okay. Do you have a single label like an AFI array or a dual label array? Well, with the, let me just go back here. With the Peru data, it was dual label, common reference. So I'll click on that, and now it says, okay, what do I want to do? Do I want to compare classes? Well, yeah, that is what I want to do. One class is pre-treatment and one class is post-treatment. But what are the other options here? Well, what if I had a richer data set and I had for each tumor sample, I had a grade measure, and on a scale of 1 to 4 or something. I could say, well, I want to find the genes that are correlated, whose expression is correlated with that graded grade. And that would be finding genes correlated with a quantitative variable. Or what if I had for these patients a survival, and I wanted to see the genes that were tended to be associated with longer survival versus shorter survival? You know, what genes have a correlation with survival? And the survival was sometimes censored, and I wanted to use the kind of statistics that usually go with that, like proportional hazard model. Then I'd click on correlated with survival. Well, what if I had a time course experiment in which I shut off the, going back to my earlier example, I shut off the blood supply to the kidney of these mice and then did sacrifice at various times. And I wanted to find the genes that, and in some cases I had arrays pre-treatment, in some cases I had 1 hour, in some cases 3 hours, etc. And I wanted to find the genes that were correlated with survival, with time, or they're even more complicated sort of time course analyses where maybe I would have had two treatment groups, untreated and treated, and I had the time course sort of structure for both of them, and I wanted to either find genes that were changing with time or find genes that were changing with time differently for the two groups. That would be a time course analysis. So here, with this Peru data, pre versus post, it's just two classes. And so I'm going to say comparing classes. And now it's giving me some other options. Comparing classes of samples. And so there's class comparison and there's SAM, the statistical analysis of microarray. And I'm going to do the class comparison, but there's some other options here, comparing things to the common reference. Well, no, this is data from Stanford, and their common reference was just a bunch of cell lines, and that's not what we wanted to do. We have this other thing we'll talk about later, gene set analysis, where we don't want to do things on a gene-by-gene basis, but we want to look at sets of genes, and built into BRB array tools, the sets can be genes in the same pathway, either defined by, we have three kinds of sets of pathways, either the gene ontology sets or the, I'm sorry, the pathways would be the BioCarta pathways or the KEG pathways or the, at the Whitehead Institute, they have a database of pathways and expression signatures. In other words, they've collected some gene sets of genes that get turned, that get induced when you downregulate P53 and things like that. That's a set of pathways, and we've built into BRB array tools to sort of download those pathways from the Whitehead Institute database. In most cases, we actually build the pathways right in to include them in BRB array tools. In the case of the Whitehead Institute stuff, we didn't do that because we didn't want to violate their copyright, but we set up sort of a very transparent thing for the user that automatically lets you, the user, click on OK, you accept their copyright, and then it automatically downloads it into your computer. And then we have various more fancy analysis of variance kinds of things for gene finding. But for here, and if you wanted to know more about, well, what do these things do, you can click on the help button. This tool finds differentially expressed genes among predefined classes of samples. The classes have been defined based on columns in the experiment descriptor file. The gene list can be determined using either a univariate significance threshold or using the multivariate permutation test. The multivariate permutation test controls either the proportion or the number of false discoveries at a specific confidence level. We'll talk more about that when we go back to the slides. And what is SAM? This tool is another method for identifying differentially expressed genes by controlling for false discoveries. It is similar in concept to the multivariate permutation test and has been implemented based on the algorithm developed by Tuescher et al. Although, like I say, our implementation is 10 times faster than what Tuescher's was. Okay, so we'll just do class comparison. And it tells us what? To return to the wizard after the analysis, please click the wizard icon on the Excel menu bar. And that's what the wizard icon looks like. Okay. And what it does, it brings up this dialogue for doing the class comparison. This is what we had the screenshot of on that PowerPoint slide. Now, I could have, if I knew that I wanted to do just a class comparison, I didn't have to go through that wizard at all. I could have just gone to the BRBRA tools menu directly and gone to class comparison in between groups of arrays. But, okay, so here we are. And the first thing it wants to know is, okay, well, it tells us a little bit about this analysis. And then experimental design. What column in your experiment descriptor worksheet defines the classes? Okay, so here's what I was saying before. The columns you put in this experiment descriptor worksheet are really going to tell the program what comparisons you want to make. Now here, I'll just click on this, and it shows me in this pull-down menu, it displays all of the column headers that I've defined in that experiment descriptor worksheet. And for the analysis I want to do, it's the before-after column is the one that defines the classes, because I want to compare the before to the after, right? And at any time in the analysis, I can define new columns. And then when I just save my project before I quit and go to lunch, it'll save that new experiment descriptor worksheet, and it'll be part of your project when you open it up again next time, whenever that is. Now it's going to ask something else about my experimental design. Do you have unpaired samples or do you have paired samples? Now, BRBRA tools has defaults for everything in terms of either what we put in is recommended or what is usually the case. Now, in this case, we actually have paired samples in the sense that we've got two arrays for each patient. And so the two arrays, the before and the after, are paired by patient. And so I have to say paired samples. Now, when I say paired samples, it lights up this box, and it wants to know, okay, well, tell me what column of your experiment descriptor worksheet gives the pairing. And it doesn't care anything about what kind of coding you're using. It's just going to use, just as long as the things that are paired have the same character string in them, spelled the same way. It doesn't care whether they're numbers, they're letters, any of that. As long as you didn't make any typos and whatever. Similarly, before or after, it didn't care what kind of coding I used for after or before. I could have used numbers, I could have used letters, I could have used whatever I wanted. I just have to use them consistently. So here I'm going to pair by, I call that patient ID. So I'll just click on patient ID. Now in some cases, see, I could have said, if I had said unpaired, it would have asked me, well, do I want to block by something? So what if you had actually done, an experiment, and you didn't actually have your data paired pre versus post, but you had done some of your, you had arrayed some of your samples with one set of slides and some of your samples with a different set of slides, and you were concerned about differences resulting from those two different sets of slides. You didn't want to confound, you know, your before-after comparison with the fact that you might be unbalanced. You might have used more of the befores with the first set of slides and more of the afters with the latter set of slides. You hope it's not completely confounded, but it might be somewhat unbalanced, and you want to sort of correct for that. So I could, in that case, have said, I have unpaired samples, but I want to block by, and then I would just make a column in which I would say slide set one or slide set two, or slide set early or slide set late. I would have had to made a column and given that column some kind of a name in the column header, calling it slide set for that new column, and then that new name would have appeared in pull-down lists, and I could have selected that as the thing to block the analysis by. And that blocked analysis would essentially be a two-way analysis of variance. And so here we have pairing. We've taken care of that. And now the stuff over here is sort of how do we want to control for multiplicity, for the fact that we're doing a whole bunch of analyses on a gene by gene basis, we want to get answers for all of the genes represented on the array. Whether we're doing it on a gene by gene basis or not will depend on what we click over here. Well, the simplest sort of analysis we can do is just do significance threshold of univariate tests. Here it's going to do t-tests, or something we call a modified t-test, which we'll discuss down here. And it says, well, calling a gene, well, what's the threshold for significance for these t-tests? Well, the default is 0.001. And if, you know, in traditional sort of statistical analysis, the default threshold for statistical analysis is 0.05. But if you do a thousand t-tests and you call things significant at the 0.05 level, then the average number of false positives is 0.05 times 1,000, which is about 50. And so and if you do 10,000 of them, the average number of false positives is 0.05 times 10,000, which is about 500. So even though microarray analysis is not like doing pivotal studies to be submitted to the FDA, where you have to be very conservative and stringent, and you're going to come up with one answer, and you want to make sure that you want to control completely to have a high probability of no false positives. The microarray context is that you can accept some false positives, but you don't want too many, because eventually you're going to want to do something with the genes that you think that appear to be differentially expressed. You either want to try to make biological sense out of them, in which case you're going to have to do a lot of work of figuring out what's known about those genes in terms of using the annotations that BRBRA tools gives you and going from there, or you're going to have to do some kind of confirmatory study with RT-PCR or whatever. And so you don't want 500 false positives. So the way you do that is, instead of using the traditional 0.05, the simplest way of controlling it is using a much more stringent significance level. 0.001 means about one false positive per 1,000 comparisons on average. And if you do 10,000 comparisons, that means about, on average, about 10 false positives, which for many studies is fine, is not a problem. If you wind up with finding 100 genes that are differentially expressed, that appear significant at the 0.001 level, and you can say, well, I use the 0.001 significance level, and so I expect about 10 false positives out of this 100. That's not so bad. You know, then that means 90% of them are probably right. And that's a... we'll talk about it in a minute. It means like your false discovery rate for those 100 genes is 10%, because 10 out of the 100 you believe are false positives. The other more complicated analyses are basically for this multivariate permutation test, in which you can do, and we'll talk about how those work, to either restrict the proportion of false discoveries or the number of false discoveries. The number meaning, say, well, we don't want more than 10 false discoveries, or we want to have 80% confidence that there are not more than 10 false discoveries. And or we want to say, we don't want more than 10% false discovery rate. Of the genes that we claim are differentially expressed, we want to have 80% confidence that not more than 10% of those are false positives. That's what that's the kind of statement these multivariate permutation tests permit you to make. So it's a stronger statement than what SAM permits you to make, because SAM doesn't permit you to sort of specify these confidence levels. And we'll talk about what this random variance model is when we get back to the slides. And we see, what is this thing down here? The analysis is currently set to run on all the genes passing the filter, but you can actually restrict it to selected gene subsets. There's also always an option button down here. And what are some, we usually put on the option page for that, and that dialogue, the things that you usually don't want to change. Well, okay, this says perform univariate permutation tests. And it's rather than do t-tests with p-values calculated using the normal distribution that, on which t-tests are based, we want to actually we'll calculate t-statistics, but then do univariate permutation tests based on those t-statistics. For reasons I'll describe when we get back to the slides, that's usually not a good idea. The multivariate permutation tests are a much better idea than doing those univariate permutation tests. And there's also a thing about a global test. In other words, and that's just an additional thing. In other words, suppose we wound up with 100 genes that are significant at the 0.001. If we click this box, the output will also say, well, if based on permutations of the class labels, what's the probability that just by chance, if there were no true differential expression among the classes, that you'd wind up with 100 or more genes significant at the 0.001 level? And we used to have that in, and then we took it out because I figured we were giving people too many p-values. This one is a little hard to explain. But then we put it back in because some people missed it. And there's another thing where we can perform a gene ontology observed versus expected analysis on the resulting set of genes that come out significant at the 0.001 level, in which we calculate the observed and expected, which gene ontology categories seem to be overrepresented in that gene list. But our gene set analysis tool is actually a much better kind of way of analyzing gene ontology than just sort of annotating the gene list with regard to gene ontology the way this does. Most analysis programs use this kind of an approach to just sort of, you get your genes by using some kind of a stringence level of gene by gene analysis, and then you annotate that gene list with regard to gene ontology. And it's not really a good approach, and I'll describe a better approach later when we get back to the slides. The other thing you can do here is it's going to create the output of this analysis is going to be presented to you in an in a in an HTML file opened by your, with your web browser open to display it. And that's the way BRB Array Tools presents output. And that way we don't have to worry about format defaults on your computer. And you can save that HTML file. You can give it a name here. It automatically saves it, but you should give it a name. Another, I might want to call it before versus after. And now I click OK here, and it takes me back to the main page. And I'm going to, I'll say use the random. Let me just unclick this for a moment until I describe what it is. And then I'll say, okay. So now it's doing the calculations. And when it finishes, it will present the results in a HTML file. Now it's done. One thing I can't figure out how to stop my web browser from blocking pop-ups, and I'm gonna, so, but anyway, so it has, this is just displayed, this is just an HTML file, which is also saved, the program saves it in the, my output subfolder of my project folder, and I have a project for this Peru analysis, which it has created, when, and so at any time I can relook at this output by just opening that that file. And the name of the file is well, I think it's, you know, it's the name I gave it there. It's class comparison before versus after. And so it tells me a little bit. Now if I click on help, it'll tell me something about how to read the information given. But what it says, it gives me a little summary information. There were two classes. How many genes passed the filtering criteria? This was an old experiment that Peru published, and it had only, after, and we did, I think we used his filtering, and so there were about 3,000 genes represented on that cDNA array. And basically it did a paired t-test. And the column of the experiment descriptor sheet that defined the class variable was before or after, and we used a 0.001 level of significance. The number of genes significant at the 0.001 level was 13, so it found 13 genes. And the, here they are. And for these 13 genes, it gives us the t-test p-value, and so these genes I think are ordered by p-value. It gives us something called the false discovery rate, which is just a very simple Benjamini-Hochberg approximation to the false discovery rate, which we'll discuss when we get back to the slides. And it gives this sort of geometric mean of the after versus before ratios. Now, if this hadn't been paired, it would have actually given a geometric mean of the expression level in each class. But because they're paired, this is sort of a better summary of the degree of differential expression of these genes. And so these are like, you know, this one is actually a twofold. So there's a bunch that are about twofold. There's nothing whoppingly different. And then the ones down here, I guess it's sorted, it's probably not strictly sorted by p-value. These are, well, I guess they are sorted by p-value. And some of these, the fold seem is less than one, meaning that the in most, when the fold is greater than one, it means the after, the gene was induced. The after is greater than the before. When it's less than one, it means it went the other way around. Incidentally, Peru originally published this data saying there were no before versus after differences, because he did a cluster analysis, and from that didn't see anything. And we, Korn and I was a co-author on it, we republished it, sort of showing, well, that's really not the right analysis, and if you really do the right analysis, there are some genes, and we showed the relationship of some of these genes to doxorubicin, which is what when patients were treated with. And so for the Peru data, I guess the identifier given was a GenBank accession number. And we, in importing this data, BRB Array Tools has automatically gone to the Stanford Source website and downloaded annotations for all of the genes on this array using the GenBank accession number. And so if you want to see something about, we include right here in this thing something about a summary of what each of these genes is. But you can get more information, say, about this gene, W96134, by clicking this. And it tells you this gene is a putative transforming gene of avian sarcoma virus, et cetera, et cetera. It gives you the gene ontology information, molecular function, cellular component, biological process for that gene. It gives you the BioCarta pathways that that gene is in. And if you click on that pathway, I think it should show you a picture of that pathway, which we obtain from a BioCarta website at the NCI. Oh, for some reason that part of it isn't working. Can't seem to. Sometimes, you know, the hyperlinks that these websites change what they, you know, the way they want to be referenced, and we find all of a sudden some link is broken, and we have to adjust the program. But you know, we can get. We can go to find what does GeneCard have on that gene. And so it'll hyperlink to the GeneCard database at the Weizmann Institute. So the display we're seeing here, I'm having some problem with any of these links. I don't know whether, I'm not sure why it is, but anyway, you should be able to hyperlink to LocusLink, the Weizmann Institute, the Source Database, any of these other sort of places. And and so that's it also gives you as your output sort of a chromosomal distribution of this set of 13 genes and sort of an expected. An observed and an expected chromosomal distribution were expected based on, we look at each gene represented on the array and what chromosomes those were on. And you didn't have to put any of that information in. The only information that was imported was a GenBank accession number for with the expression data, and all of the other annotations were automatically obtained by bioreactors. So we'll close that HTML file. It's saved in case we want it. And now let's go back to the slides and learn more about some. Oh, well, actually, I guess maybe what we'll should we break for lunch at this point? Because it is after 12. I think we probably should break for lunch. And should we come back and try to get started at about 10 after 1 to give people an hour for lunch?
Jeffy said just we start at 1 o'clock.
Want to start at 1? Okay. So whatever people want to do. Okay. And they go downstairs? Is that...
I think the dining room is on the same floor. I think some people will hear us there. And if you use your laptop computer and you need to charge your battery, you also can do that. They maybe have 400 watts there. So